So welcome to the second half of the last class on this Britain since the Romans. And what I want to do is just to point out some highlights of the first half of the 20th century. And then I will put on the blog a link to the two half-hour classes I did on the Britain since 1945. So with a bit of luck, you're getting things back into order a little bit, and then things will be better. So what can we say about the 20th century? Well, certainly, as I was saying, by this time Britain is very powerful in the world. But also at home, there's a lot going on. The very end of the 19th century, things seem to be moving. Yet 1884, most working men have the vote, and the campaign for women to have the vote is something. But also from a cultural point of view, it's quite an exciting time. This is an amazing time for children's literature. All the books like Peter Pan and what's the other extremely famous one? Alice in Wonderland, yeah, they're all written about this time. And there's about six or seven, yeah, and there's also Chesterton and people like that. There's some great thing. And Oscar Wilde might be a symbol of the dandies of the end of the twentieth century. He's famous for his one-liners, and indeed his theatre is often made up of one-liners, where he doesn't mind abandoning character and plot as long as it makes a good joke. Famously, he said, "There is only one thing worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about." So I'm a fun guy. He was, of course, gay, and he was in prison for a number of years because he was accused of, because he was found guilty of homosexual relations. And he wrote famously the Ballad of Reading Jail while he was in there, in Reading Jail. And one of the fascinating things about him is that for a long, long time there were no statues of him in the public space, because, you know, and there's this wonderful statue of him in Berlin, a multicolour statue, which was established at the end of the 1990s. So it really took a long time. So what's happening at the beginning of the 20th century? Well, this is the time, historically, of the foundation of the social democratic parties across the world. In France, the SFIO, in Germany, the Sozialistische Demokratische Partei, in Japan, almost everywhere, except the United States for rather specific reasons, has a new kind of political party, which is established based on its links to the trade unions. So the trade unions are big organizations, millions of people in them, who are looking for a better deal for workers. And in Britain, you get the foundation of the Labour Party in 1900. Because most working men get the vote, most of them were going to vote Liberal at the beginning. And indeed, the Liberal Party agreed with trade unions to sponsor a certain number of members of Parliament. But the trade unions were generally unhappy with the results of this, because the Liberals were not really a workers' party. And so the foundation of the Labour Party in 1900, and of course, when they found it, it's quite small, they're not expecting it to become one of the two big parties of the 20th century. And the Liberals will be pushed out, and you'll have an alternation between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party in the 20th century, partly encouraged by the fact that the elections are a single round with a first-past-the-post system. I say that because I've always seen this in students' work, when they say that a first past the post. C'est celui qui a le plus de voix à gagner l'élection. C'est-à-dire qu'en principe, s'il y a 100 candidats, et il y en a 99 qui ont un voix, et le dernier qui a deux voix, il a gagné. C'est fini. That, of course, it doesn't work like that. In practice, it encourages huge parties, and it makes life extremely difficult for small parties. Whereas the two-round system in France makes it possible for small parties to do something. So the foundation of the Labour Party. The Labour Party was founded by three groups of people: trade union leaders, who were fed up with the Liberal Party because they weren't doing much for them; Marxists, who realised that there were not many Marxists, and so thought we need more people to get things done; and Christians, radical Christians. And this is very, very important. Notice the name of the party. Names are important. This is the only one that's not called the Socialist Party. The French is the Socialist, International Ouvrière. C'est un mauvais exemple à France, on va prendre les autres. In any case, during the 20th century, you have the Parti Socialiste in France, and the word socialist in Spain, Italy, everywhere, the word socialist, but not in Britain, the Labour Party. This is not an accident, it's never an accident, names are important. And so you get this alliance. And the Labour Party has always been quite broad, with on the left Marxists who believe that you need to fight to make things better now, but until we get rid of capitalism, it's not really going to get much better. And those on the right who think, well, capitalism is good, but we need pressure to make sure that the poorer and the working people are not too badly treated. And these people are in the same party. And this means that sometimes the Labour Party goes vroom, vroom. And this has happened recently because Jeremy Corbyn, who was the leader of the Labour Party for a few years until 2019, was very much on the left of the party. He was not a Marxist, but he was somebody who said, you know, really, well, we support strikes, we support trade unions. He did fine for a few years. And when he resigned after the results in the election were a little disappointed, he got a new leader who was completely the other side. Keir Starmer, he's the present leader of the Labour Party, and he's really on the right of the Labour Party and saying, oh, well, you know, we must take some of the good ideas of the Conservatives and so on. So this seems surprising. The Labour Party, the leadership of the Labour Party appears to go like that, and it's because it's very, very broad. Whereas in France, during the classic period of the 20th century, you had two left parties, the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, and this led to other complicated things. But you have to imagine the Labour Party from 1930 to 1990, as if in France the Socialist Party and the Communist Party were inside the same party. Now, I know you're not all experts on French politics either. Here you have then an election poster for Labour, sacrifice, and it's a joke. Here is the £10,000 a year man, the £1,000 a year man, the £250 a year man, the unemployed man. And the man at the top says, equality of sacrifice. Let's all step down one rung. And you can see, of course, this will drown the unemployed man. Vote Labour to avoid this attitude. Britain is becoming a democratic party. In 1918, the remaining third of working class men get the votes. And all women over 30 for a bizarre reason. They always used to say in the history books that women over 30 got the vote to thank them for their work during the war. But in fact, it was more women under 30 who did the work during the war, so that wasn't the reason. What was the reason? Hard to say. There was a lot of opposition to women getting the vote, of course, by traditionalists who felt that it was not women's role. But there were also hesitations in the Labour Party, because women were at this time more conservative than men, which was partly connected with a lot of women not going out to work but working at home. I mean, working at home with their children and so on. It makes you more traditional when you don't go out and see the world. Yeah, it was true that women were more conservative than men until the 1940s. This was not, in my opinion, a good reason that women should not have the vote, but this was one of the arguments going around. Now, the Liberal government from 1905 to 1915 was under pressure. They realised that the Labour Party was coming into view, beginning to have some importance, and they realised that because now the working class men had the votes. So they were under pressure, and so the Liberal government, following the German government — the Germans were the first people to bring in this kind of reform — introduced a series of social reforms which were tremendously important. 1906, for the first time, poor children could get free meals at school. We're talking about the situation of tremendous poverty, where it may well be the only meal they get. In 1908, the first old age pensions, 5 shillings a week. In 1909, the first labour exchanges. Now, the labour exchanges, it's a comme le pôle emploi, si vous voulez. It's a place where you can go if you're unemployed. But it's a recognition that if people are unemployed, the government should do something. The whole idea of the welfare state is the number of things the government should do is getting much bigger. in the middle of the 19th century, the government fund. It's terrible that there are poor people who are hungry, but that's not a government problem. That's a problem for charities or church or I don't know. Yeah. And so the whole idea of the welfare state, which is not the best word really, welfare state, but if we call it that, is this much more general. So it's a tremendous human progress because it's the idea that, you know, our brother's problem is our problem. But it makes the government have a much more big... And then 1911, the National Health Insurance Act, which means that you can get some money if you're sick. And also that you can pay for some doctors. This is not yet free doctors. Free doctors is 1948. So, nevertheless, significant reforms. And this is also the period of the fight for women's suffrage, 1860 to 1914. 1860 to 1914. So that's 54 years. Il faut se les taper, les 54 ans de militantisme. You've got to always remember that dates in the past were just as far away as they are now. Very often you say, oh, well, you know, immediately afterwards, 20 years later. But in fact, you're 20 years, you have to do it. And generations of women, and sometimes men, were fighting for the right to vote. And gradually had some success. I chose this deliberately. This is so you can see that this is a banner which you take on a demonstration from the Northern Men's Federation for Women's Suffrage. This is a men's support group. Now, the campaign for women's votes had some intermediate successes. At one point, first of all, it was accepted that women could be part of school government boards. They could be elected to school committees organising schools. Now, of course, this is very, in some ways, a very small step forward, but it was nevertheless the idea that women can go to meetings and read minutes and debate and so on. And then there was some women got the vote in local elections. So these were happening little by little. Nevertheless, after 40 years or so, famously, Emmeline Pankhurst and her family decided that things were not going fast enough, and they founded a new organisation, the Women's Social and Political Union. I think it's founded in 1902. But in any case, the year before or the year after or otherwise. And its slogan was, action, not words. So we're fed up of writing petitions. And having demonstrations, there were huge demonstrations at the time. The demonstrations were quite interesting because when you had a huge demonstration in Hyde Park, you had like 20 or 30 stages around because they have no microphones. And so the speaker would speak for 10 minutes and then go to the next stage and speak for 10 minutes and the next speaker would come. So it was a really exciting sort of time. People learned how to speak. And so they began direct action. First of all, they did things like burning letterboxes, the boxes of the street. Now, today if you burn letterboxes, it looks a bit silly. But remember, when you have almost no telephones and no social media and no internet, the letters were full of all the country's business, and burning letterboxes was a major problem for the economy. So it was actually quite smart. They also burnt down the house of some minister or other. In general, they decided that what they wanted was direct action without killing anybody. Now, this is interesting because in other situations, groups of people who are denied the vote have organised military responses. This was quite complicated for women because most women lived each one with a man. That's what people did in general and still do, in the fact. And so it's rather a special new sort of situation where you don't have a geographical base because there's no town which has all the women in it, like you could do with ethnic groups or so on. And all other sorts. And famously in 1911, I think, there was an attempt to protest at a horse race. And Emily Davison was the suffragette who threw herself, who tried to stop the king's horse, not the horse ridden by the king, but the horse owned by the king, and was killed by the horse. And so she became the suffragette hero, the heroine. The government were tremendously negative about the idea of women's suffrage. Also began to be very repressive about the direct action, and so the women were put into prison And then many of them went on hunger strike, and then they were force-fed. It's no fun being forced. I mean, this is like force-fed through the nose, yeah? So it's a very, very violent situation. And it didn't win one way or the other before the First World War. It didn't win one way or the other. And then the First World War came along in 1914. And the First World War stopped the women's suffrage campaign. The main leaders said, stop fighting for the suffrage, we need to win the war. The name of the suffragette newspaper, before the war it was called The Suffragette, and then they changed its name to Britannia. Again, ça veut dire le mérite de la clarté. Emmeline Pankhurst was a strong supporter of the war. A small group of suffragettes who were against the war broke away, but most of the suffragette leaders, just like most of the trade union leaders, most of the intellectuals, were very enthusiastic about the war. This was even more present in society because in 1914 there was no conscription, there was no military service. Very different from in France, there was a long military service. And on the first day of the war in France, all men were part of the army by decree. Whereas in Britain, they had to campaign for volunteers. They had a volunteer army, which has military advantages. And this is why you have these huge campaigns. I'm not going to go into any detail about the First World War, but it was not very nice. Okay, you got that? You have a British cemetery in France. The British cemeteries in France are still today run by a British organisation, the Commonwealth Graves Commission. And they're a fascinating thing because at the beginning of the war, when a few people, when the first soldiers died, rich families said, oh, well, I want to bring the body of my son home. Then the government thought, well, do we really want large numbers of bodies arriving in England every day? It's not good war propaganda. And so they passed a law, nobody may bring, of course it was not politically acceptable to say, okay, rich people can bring their boys home, but not the poor people, even in 1914. And so there was a law passed, it was not possible to bring them home. And they invented this idea that everybody should have the same gravestone, which is completely new. I mean, 100 years before, in the Napoleonic Wars, they had a grave for the officers and the soldiers. They just threw them in the ditch, you know. It was really, really new. And it's a sign of the democratic spirit. The right to vote is just... See, the right to vote is actually just a symbol for the idea that everybody has useful things in their head. It's not really about voting, although voting is useful. It's really about the democratic spirit in the sense of the people should have a say. In everyday life. And so the First World War is treated by governments and by historians in a much more democratic way than previous wars. And so the hero of the war in the 19th century is Kitchener and all these imperial generals. The hero of the First World War in popular culture and even in government propaganda is Tommy and Jack, the ordinary soldier and the ordinary sailor. So eventually the war ends, and the war ends in a tremendous rise of social protest. Because of the war, there is the revolution in Russia in 1917, a revolution in Germany, which is not successful in 1919, 2 years of general strikes in Italy, the Biennio Rosso, revolution in other parts of Eastern Europe, and a huge strike in Britain in 1919, which included the police going on strike. The government really doesn't like it when the police goes on strike because it's a sign of social unrest. And we get into the 20s with, first of all, a tremendous decline in the popularity of the cause of the First World War. There was a huge disillusion. Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, had said, we will build a land fit for heroes. A land fit for heroes. Un pays approprié pour les héros. And of course, we are more cynical than they were at the time, and we're not surprised that it didn't happen like that. 1924, the first Labour government, and this was, however, the first Labour government was a minority government. and so was not able to pass many laws, although they did pass an important law about housing standards, minimum housing standards. In 1926, the economic crisis was pushing the mine owners, the coal companies, to reduce wages among miners. There are more than a million miners, huh? We've forgotten that today there are, even in countries where there are still mines, like in the 1980s in Britain there were 100,000 miners, but in the 20s there are more than a million miners. What country has more than a million miners today? China. Yeah, it's all been moved out. Germany, they do have a lot, but now I don't think they'll be up in the millions. Because it's also, of course, as you can imagine, today the miners have huge machines. Whereas in the 20s they're just hacking away at the coal. So the result was the different trade unions declared their support for the miners against the wage cut, and there was a general strike for 9 days. This is only really the second general strike in English history, the first one being in the 1840s. And this was tremendously divisive, of course. I met an old gentleman who was at university in 1926. Remember, in 1926, only the elite went to university. And he during the miner strike, he and his friends went to the bridges on the railways and threw coal at the students who were the bourgeois students who were driving the trains to break the strike. Yeah, that was his thing, throwing coal at them. There were only two. The newspapers were stopped, but there were only two newspapers available: the British Gazette, which here is saying the real meaning of the strikes, and this is the government piece. But you have to be careful with propaganda, if you're a government, if ever you're a government, you have to be careful with propaganda, because if you only tell only one side, people don't believe you. So you have to have some sort of way of showing some balance as well as pushing your point of view. And indeed at this moment, the BBC, which had been started in 1922, the radio became tremendously important. And in every village there was one radio and people would go and listen to the news six times a day. And indeed this was probably the best thing that ever happened to the BBC, because they showed the government how important the BBC is and that the BBC can be trusted. And so the next year they were made into the British Broadcasting Corporation, a nationalised corporation, and they have survived since. And here is the other newspaper by the trade union, the British Worker, the official strike news bulletin. In any case, the general strike, after 9 days, the trade union leadership agreed to end the strike, and the miners continued for a few months alone. It was a defeat. It was a defeat for the trade unions, the general strike. But the Labour movement and the Labour Party still were then hoping for progress on the parliamentary side, progress in the government. They'd already had the minority government in 1924, which had had two major events connected to it. Firstly, a law about housing, as I mentioned. And secondly, there were actually two elections in 1924. The Labour Party won the first one and lost the second one. And one of the reasons they lost the second one was because of one of the most famous frauds in the history of England. This is the Zinoviev letter. That is a newspaper published a letter from the Russian revolutionaries saying, "Dear British comrades, prepare for the revolution." It proved, according to the conservative newspaper, that inside the Labour Party there were dangerous communists. Now, the letter was written in Berlin by some right-wing Russians. It was a complete false, but it was considered true until the election in 1924, and it was part of the means used to get rid of the Labour Party. 5 years later, in 1929, this is the height and the collapse, if you like, of morale in the Labour Party. The Labour Party won a majority government. They had a majority of members of Parliament. So finally, led by Ramsay MacDonald, who was a socialist hero at the time, had been not in favour of the First World War, for example. And so they had a Labour government, and in the Labour Party it was absolute joy. For the first time ever, there was a workers' government. Several of the ministers were miners. You know, aristocrat miners, you know, so it was absolute huge excitement. Sadly, of course, 1929 is famous for another thing, that is a world economic crisis, the biggest world economic crisis. And Ramsay MacDonald, faced with this crisis, decided that the best thing to do was to, the most important thing was national unity, and so he formed a new government, mostly. Most of the MPs were conservative. He formed a national government with a Ramsay MacDonald leadership, but mostly conservatives in it, and he was expelled from his own party. So this was a terrible episode for Labour Party people. That 1929, the great hope of finally, and people had even higher hopes because there'd never been one before. You know, so, oh yeah, poverty will be finished soon. We have a Labour government. Yeah, it was that the very, very high level of expectation. And only 2 years later, a national government cutting the money for unemployed people, imposing austerity, and so on. And so this is the lowest moment for Labour Party people in the 20th century is 1931. And indeed for the left in general, because 1933 is generally referred to on the left as midnight in the century. Yeah, the worst moment of the 20th century, 1933. Hitler became Chancellor in Germany, and Stalin killed the last revolutionaries in Russia. So among the 11, 1933 was there. I had a very old friend who's dead now, who was a socialist activist. And when some young person said to him, "Oh, it's very hard at the moment, isn't it, for left-wing people?" This guy Cliff, he would say, "Hard? You should have been in Poland when the Nazis invaded." Yeah, it's a really tremendously amusing gentleman. Okay, now the 1930s is mass unemployment, huge unemployment, and this led partly to revolts. There were the National Unemployed Movement marches and the Jarrow March, people marching and protesting for more rights for unemployed people, more money for unemployed people, but also the rise of fascism in Britain. And this is Oswald Mosley, the British fascist leader. And in the 30s, when he had a big meeting, he had the meeting in a football stadium. Yeah? Not in a cafe, in a football stadium. So there was a really big thing. And in many ways, Britain was lucky. Yeah, fascism could have come to Britain first. Now, there are a number of reasons why this didn't happen. Well, one of them is that Mosley's many, many thousands of supporters decided to have a show of strength in London and decided in 1936 to organise a march in the Jewish part of town. So a provocative march. And this was at Cable Street. However, this is a memorial plaque. The local trade unions and the Communist Party and many local Jews, some of whom were in the Communist Party, organized a huge demonstration, so that when Mosley arrived with 10,000 people, there were 200,000 people there to stop them. This is Cable Street, the Battle of Cable Street, which is tremendously symbolic for the left in Britain. Yeah, the Cable Street is one of those great moments. And indeed, many, many years later, you have celebration. Today it's 1936 to 2021. How many years is that? Help me here. It's at some round number with a five on the end, and there are celebrations this week about that. So the British government in the 1930s was not keen on a war with Germany. They could see that, you know, fascism was about war, and that Hitler was, you know, not a very nice gentleman. I think we can agree on that. But they weren't keen on a war. And one of the reasons was that I don't want to excuse them too much, but one of the reasons was that the British government was convinced that only 20 years after the previous war, the people didn't want a war and would not accept a war. That's the first thing. And the second thing was that the government was convinced, and they had psychologists' reports to say this, that if there was mass bombing, that the general mental health would not survive it, that people would just go mad. Because they had no experience of mass bombing of towns, which is a horrible thing, but they didn't think that people could survive it. They thought, well, we just have everybody mad. And so there are a number of reasons why they worked very hard, probably too hard, to avoid war with Hitler. And famously, Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister, came back from talks with Hitler with a piece of paper. I have here a piece of paper signed by Mr. Hitler, which means peace in our time. However, there was one isolated, relatively discredited conservative politician who was always convinced that there would be a war with Germany. And this is Winston Churchill. Now, Winston Churchill had been a leader of the First World War, and he had had the idea of invading Turkey at Gallipoli. It was a disaster, absolutely disaster. And in the 20s, he was quite isolated. Yeah, he was a conservative member of parliament, but you know, he didn't have many friends. But he was somebody who really felt himself as a leader. And you know, every day he would write a note to some minister. You should be doing this. You should be. And he was nobody. He was just an MP. He wasn't. He was isolated, but he was certainly had a tremendous amount of energy. And of course, if he had died in 1933 or 1936, he would have been remembered as a failure, because of the First World War. So history was good to him. He was also a historian, and after the Second World War, he wrote a six-volume history of the Second World War. Indeed, he said, "History will be kind to me because I intend to write it." So certainly a gentleman who you would like to have on your side, because he was really very, very sharp. And of course, his story is the story of the Second World War. And I'm going to stop there, and I will simply give you links to go from 1945. Thank you for being so attentive.